Welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And podcasts of Religion in the News broadcasts are available on our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program features an article that we broadcast earlier this year and is the first of a two-part series. This article takes up the majority of two full programs and is well worth your time. If you haven't listened to it before, I think you'll really enjoy this. The article is from the January-February issue of The Atlantic Magazine, and the title of the article is The Most American Religion. The subheadline, Perpetual Outsiders, Mormons Spent 200 Years Assimilating to a Certain National Ideal, only to find their country in an identity crisis. What will the third century of the faith look like? And this article is by McKay Coppins of The Atlantic. To meet with the prophet during a plague, certain protocols must be followed. It's a gray spring morning in Salt Lake City, and downtown Temple Square is deserted, giving the place an eerie post-apocalyptic quality. The doors of the Silver Dome Tabernacle are locked. The towering neo-Gothic temple is dark. To enter the church administration building, I meet a handler who escorts me through an underground parking garage, past a security checkpoint where my temperature is taken, up a restricted elevator, and then finally into a large mahogany-walled conference room. After a few minutes, a side door opens, and a trim 95-year-old man in a suit greets me with a hygienic elbow bump. "We always start our meetings with a word of prayer," says Russell M. Nelson, the president of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. "So, if we may..." The official occasion for our interview is the Mormon Bicentennial. Two centuries ago, a purported opening of the heavens in upstate New York launched one of the most peculiar and enduring religious movements in American history, and Nelson designated 2020 as a year of commemoration. My notebook is full of reporterly questions to ask about the church's future, the painful tensions within the faith over race and LGBTQ issues, and the unprecedented series of changes Nelson has implemented in his brief time as prophet. But as we bow our heads, I realize that I'm also here for something else. For the past 2 months, I've been cooped up in quarantine, watching the world melt down in biblical fashion. All the death and pestilence and doom-scrolling on Twitter has left me unmoored. And from somewhere deep in my spiritual subconscious, a Mormon children's song I grew up singing has resurfaced. Follow the prophet, don't go astray. Follow the prophet, he knows the way. As president of the church, Nelson is considered by Mormons to be God's messenger on earth, a modern heir to Moses and Abraham. Sitting across from him now, some part of me expects a grand and ancient gesture in keeping with this calamitous moment, a raised staff, an end times prophecy, a summoning of heavenly powers. Instead, he smiles and asks me about my kids. Over the next hour, Nelson preaches a gospel of silver linings. When I ask him about the lockdowns that have forced churches to close, he muses that homes can be sanctuaries of faith. When I mention the physical ravages of the virus, he marvels at the human body's miraculous defense mechanisms. Reciting a passage from the Book of Mormon, "Adam fell that men might be, and men are, that they might have joy," he offers a reminder that feels like a call to repentance. There can be joy in the saddest of times. There is something classically Mormon about this aversion to wallowing. When adversity strikes, my people tend to respond with can-do aphorisms and rolled-up sleeves, with an unrelenting helpfulness that can border on caricature. Early in the pandemic, when Nelson ordered the church to suspend all worship services worldwide and start donating its stockpiles of food and medical equipment, he chalked it up to a desire to be good citizens and good neighbors. This onslaught of earnest optimism can be grating to some. "There's always a Mormon around when you don't want one," David Foster Wallace once wrote, trying your patience with unsolicited kindness. But it has served the faith well. By pretty much every measure, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has defied the expectations of its early observers. In the years immediately after its founding, as Mormons were being chased across the country by state-sanctioned mobs, skeptics predicted that the movement would collapse before the century was out. Instead, it became one of the fastest-growing religions in the world. The church now averages nearly 700 converts a day. It has temples in 66 countries and financial reserves rumored to exceed $100 billion. In the past few years, Mormons have become a subject of fascination for their surprising resistance to Trumpism. Unlike most of the religious right, they were decidedly unenthusiastic about Donald Trump. From 2008 to 2016, the Republican vote share declined among Latter-day Saints more than any other religious group in the country.
And though Trump won back some of those defectors in 2020, he continued to underperform. Joe Biden did better in Utah than any Democrat since 1964, and Mormon women likely played a role in turning Arizona blue. Scholars have offered an array of theories to explain this phenomenon, that Mormon communities are models of connectedness and trust, that the church's unusual structure promotes consensus building over culture war, that the faith's early persecution has made its adherents less receptive to nativist appeals. Nelson attributes these qualities to the power of the church's teachings. "I don't think you can separate the good things we do from the doctrine," he tells me. "It's not what we do, it's why we do it." As a lifelong member of the faith, I can't help but see a more complicated story. Mormons didn't become avatars of a Norman Rockwellian ideal by accident. We taught ourselves to play the part over a centuries-long audition for full acceptance into American life. That we finally succeeded just as the country was on the brink of an identity crisis is one of the core ironies of modern Mormonism. The story of the Latter-day Saints begins with a confused teenage boy. It was the spring of 1820, and the town of Palmyra, New York, was in the throes of the Second Great Awakening. Fevered Christian revivals were everywhere, new sects were sprouting, and preachers competed fiercely for converts. To Joseph Smith, a 14-year-old farm boy with little education, the frenzy was at once exhilarating and disorienting. As he would later write in his personal history, he became consumed with the question of which church to join, sampling worship services, consulting scripturians, and growing ever more concerned about the state of his soul. The turning point in his spiritual search came when he was reading the book of James. "If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, and it shall be given him." Determined to test the thesis, he walked into a grove of trees near his family farm and knelt down to ask for guidance. What happened next, according to Smith, would be the catalyst for a new world religion, the literal restoration of Christ's church to the earth. In his own words, "I saw a pillar of light exactly over my head, above the brightness of the sun, which descended gradually until it fell upon me. When the light rested upon me, I saw two personages, whose brightness and glory defy all description, standing above me in the air. One of them spake unto me, calling me by name and saying," pointing to the other, "This is my beloved son. Hear him." I don't remember the first time I heard this story, but I do know where I was when I committed it to memory. As a Mormon teenager in suburban Massachusetts, I woke up every morning at 5:30 to attend a seminary class held in the bishop's basement. This was no mark of special devotion on my part. All the Mormon kids were expected to be there, and so all the Mormon kids were, Mormonism being a religion that prizes showing up. Most mornings we struggled to stay awake while our teacher read from the Bible, but on Fridays we ate cinnamon rolls and played scripture memorization games. Our teacher would hold up cue cards with verses scrolled across them while we repeated the words over and over until we could recite them without looking. Smith's canonized account of the first vision was the longest of the passages, but it was also the most important. The power of his story was in its implausibility. No reasonable person would accept such an outlandish claim on its face. To believe it required faith, a willingness to follow young Joseph's example. This was how our teacher framed the story, as much object lesson as historical event. "Don't believe in this because your parents do," we were told. "Go ask God for yourself." But the part of Smith's account that always resonated most with me was what happened after the vision. Word got around Palmyra, and the community turned on him. His claims were declared to be of the devil. His family was ostracized. Facing pressure to recant, Smith refused. "I had seen a vision," he wrote later. "I knew it, and I knew that God knew it, and I could not deny it." In seminary, this was treated as a coda to the main event, mentioned, if at all, as an example of standing up for unpopular beliefs. But to a 21st century teenager who was already insecure enough about his oversized head and undersized muscles without bringing a weird religion into the mix, it sounded a lot like a cautionary tale. My own testimony didn't come in a blaze of revelation, but in living the faith day to day. The church was where I felt most like myself. The green hymnals we sang from on Sundays, the sacramental wonder bread we passed down the pews, the corny youth dances in the sweaty church gym where we'd jump around to DJ Cool before closing with the prayer. These were more than just quirks of my parents' religion. They were emblems of an identity, one I could never fully reveal to my non-Mormon friends. At school, I laughed along when the boys in the cafeteria asked me how many moms I had, and I nodded thoughtfully when the girl I liked speculated, after the kidnapping of Elizabeth Smart, that she must have been an easy mark for brainwashing because she was Mormon. When the time came to apply for college, I feigned an interest in Arizona State University, just so my guidance counselor wouldn't think I was interested only in Mormon colleges. I aimed to cultivate a reputation that sanded off the edges of my orthodoxy. "He's Mormon, but he's cool." I didn't drink, but I was happy to be the designated driver. I didn't smoke pot, but I would never narc. All this posturing could be undignified, but I took pride in my ability to walk a certain line. Unlike my co-religionists in Utah, where kids went to seminary in the middle of the day, at church-owned buildings next to the high schools, I was one of only a few Mormon kids in my town. If my classmates liked me, I reasoned, it was a win for Mormons everywhere. In the pantheon of minority religion neuroses, this was not wholly original stuff, but I wouldn't realize until later just how deeply rooted the Mormon craving for approval was. The church that Joseph Smith set about building was almost achingly American. He held up the Constitution as a quasi-canonical work of providence. He published a new sacred text, the Book of Mormon, that centered on Jesus visiting the ancient Americas. He even taught that God had brought about the American Revolution so that his church could be restored in a free country, thus linking Mormonism's success to that of the American experiment. And yet, almost as soon as Smith started attracting converts, they were derided as un-American. A charismatic figure, with gleaming blue eyes and a low voice, Smith taught a profoundly optimistic theology that stood in contrast with the harsher doctrines of his day. But what made him most controversial was his commitment to establishing a new Jerusalem in the United States. The utopia he envisioned would be godly, ordered, and radically communitarian. As the Mormons searched for a place to build their Zion, they were met with an escalating campaign of persecution and mob violence. In New York, Smith was arrested at the urging of local clergy. In Ohio, he was tarred and feathered. By the time the Mormons settled in Missouri, they were viewed as enemies of the state. Their economic and political power made local officials nervous, as did their abolitionist streak. Though the church would later adopt exclusionary policies toward black people, many of its early members disapproved of slavery. Residents complained that the growing Mormon community had opened an asylum for rogues, vagabonds, and free blacks in their backyard. Mormon leaders responded with their own incendiary rhetoric. The tension came to a head on October 27, 1838, when the governor issued an extermination order demanding that all Mormons be driven out of the state or killed. A few days later, a militia descended on a Mormon settlement about 70 miles northeast of Kansas City and opened fire. Witnesses would later describe a horrific scene, women raped, bodies mutilated, children shot at close range. By the end of the massacre, 17 Mormons had been killed and homes had been looted and burned to the ground. The violence was justified in part by the portrayal of Mormons as a degenerate non-white race, an idea that would spread throughout the 19th century. Medical journals defined Mormons by their yellow, sunken, cadaverous visage and thick, protuberant lips. Cartoons depicted them as foreign reptiles sprawled out across the U.S. Capitol. At one point, the Secretary of State tried to institute a ban on Mormon immigration from Europe. For a time, Smith and his followers retained an almost quaint trust in America's democratic system. Even as they were forced to flee Missouri and resettle in Nauvoo, Illinois, they were convinced that the Constitution guaranteed their freedom of religion, and that if they could simply alert the nation's leaders to what was happening, all would be made right. In 1839, Smith led a delegation to Washington, D.C. to seek redress for the Mormons' violent expulsion from Missouri. In a meeting with President Martin Van Buren, the prophet presented a vividly detailed list of offenses committed against his people. But the president, fearing a backlash from Missourians, dismissed his appeals. "Your cause is just, but I can do nothing for you," Van Buren said, according to Smith's account. The experience radicalized Smith. Stung by the government's mistreatment and under siege by a growing anti-Mormon cohort, he took on a more theocratic bent. In Nauvoo, he served simultaneously as prophet, mayor, and lieutenant general of a well-armed Mormon militia. He introduced the ancient biblical practice of polygamy to his followers, eventually marrying at least 32 women himself. He convened a group of men to draft a replacement for the U.S. Constitution, which they believed had failed them. Still, the Mormons' innate Americanness made them self-conscious theocrats, constantly establishing new councils and quorums designed to disperse power and hold one another accountable. Though the church was hierarchical, it was infused with checks and balances. Congregations were led by a rotating cast of volunteers. Decisions were presented to congregants for ratification. "All things shall be done by common consent in the church," read one Mormon scripture. In 1844, Smith launched a quixotic presidential bid to draw attention to the Mormon plight. He campaigned on abolishing prisons and selling public lands to purchase the freedom of every enslaved person in the country. America, he wrote, should be a place where a person of whatever color, clime, or tongue could rejoice when he put his foot on the sacred soil of freedom. The campaign wouldn't last long. That June, Smith was arrested for ordering the destruction of an anti-Mormon printing press. While he awaited trial, a mob attacked the jail where he was being held with his brother Hiram and murdered them both. Among his followers, the prophet's death gave way to infighting, defections, and yet another flight from their homes, this time into the western desert beyond America's borders. Yet even as the Mormons fled their country, they weren't ready to disown it. In The Angel of the Prairies, a short story written by a church leader at the time, the Latter-day Saints were not victims or enemies of the American experiment, but its purest embodiment. When they no longer had a country or government to fight for, they retired to the plains of the West, carrying with them the pure spirit of freedom. Like Noah's Ark before the flood, Mormonism was to its adherents a vehicle for the preservation of America's highest ideals. One day, they believed, their former countrymen would turn to them for deliverance. It's hard to overstate just how deeply this history is woven into modern Mormon life. As little kids, we sing songs about pioneer children who walked and walked and walked and walked. When we get older, we read about pioneers burying their children in shallow graves on the brutal westward trek. The stories I grew up hearing in church about Missouri and martyrdom and Martin Van Buren were often sanitized for devotional effect, but the scars they've left on the Mormon psyche are real. At its worst, this reverence for our forebears can fuel an unhealthy persecution complex, or even be used to dismiss groups that have faced much worse oppression much more recently. In June, a Facebook page affiliated with Brigham Young University, Idaho, shared a post that compared early Mormon persecution to slavery and encouraged people of color to rise above racism. The post was deleted after student outcry. But the stories of pioneer suffering have also instilled in many American Mormons a sensitivity to the experiences of immigrants and refugees. According to one survey, Latter-day Saints are more than twice as likely as white evangelicals to say they welcomed increased immigration to the United States. When Donald Trump called for a ban on Muslim immigration, the church, hearing an eerie historical echo, issued a blistering condemnation. Later, when Trump signed an executive order allowing cities and states to veto refugee resettlement, Utah was the first red state in the country to request more refugees. Muhammad Shoaib Matar, who served as an imam in Utah for more than a decade, told me that when new people would arrive at his mosque, many of them refugees fleeing desperate circumstances, locals would show up offering food, furniture, and jobs. In some states, Muslims worried about harassment and hate crimes. But in Utah, Matar said, folks don't have this toxic view of, oh, they're foreigners, they want to take over. They don't have that mentality within them. I think it goes back to the beginning, says Elder M. Russell Ballard, a senior apostle in the church. We were really refugees. As a direct descendant of Hiram Smith, Ballard talks about the church's early history with the raw emotion of a family tragedy. We never forget, he told me, that Joseph and Hiram were gunned down in cold blood. Ballard told me about a trip he'd made to Greece on behalf of the church. During a visit to a refugee camp, he witnessed a Syrian family get tossed from a dinghy into the Aegean Sea and crawl onto the beach, shivering, soaked, and hungry. As volunteers handed them towels and food, one of the children, a 9-year-old boy named Amer, tore into a package of Oreos and offered the first one to Ballard. Today, the cookie sits encased in a small cube on the apostle's desk. A reminder, he says, to reach out to those people running for their lives all over the world. When I turned 19, I put in my papers to become a missionary and prayed to be sent abroad. I pictured myself building chapels on some far-flung island or teaching the gospel at a mountainside hut. Like most of the teenage Mormons who sign up for missionary service, I wanted an adventure, stories to tell. The church sent me to Texas. I arrived in August amid a record-breaking heat wave that seemed designed to test my faith. Huffing up hills on an 8-speed bike, necktie whipping in the wind, white shirts soaked with sweat, I wondered whether the other elders muttered bad words under their breath, too. But I came to appreciate the little miseries of missionary life, the grueling schedule, the rigid curfew, the monastic abstention from movies and TV. Each small sacrifice had its sanctifying effect. Religion without difficulty had always seemed pointless to me. The divine magic was in what faith demanded. I quickly realized that my knack for playing the likable Mormon would come in handy in the Bible Belt. Likeability, it turned out, was a big part of the job. With our black name tags and IBM salesman uniforms, missionaries were walking billboards for the church. We were trained to take rejection in stride, to cling to our good-natured wholesomeness no matter what. When a Baptist minister condemned you to hell, you smiled politely and complimented his landscaping. When someone hurled a big gulp at you from a passing car, you calmly collected the cup and looked for the nearest trash can. Once in the seedy apartment complex where I lived with another missionary, we made the mistake of leaving our laundry unattended and returned to find it drenched in urine. Not wanting to make a scene, we shrugged and pumped more quarters into the washing machine. We spent most of our time teaching prospective converts about the faith or offering English classes for local Spanish speakers. On slow days, we'd go door to door, passing out pamphlets and copies of the Book of Mormon. This was not a particularly efficient method for finding future Mormons, but we looked for small victories. I skimmed an old copy of How to Win Friends and Influence People and practiced jokes that I could deploy on strangers' doorsteps. We took consolation in these pleasant, fruitless interactions, telling ourselves that we'd improve the Mormon brand, however slightly. Planting seeds, we called it. In 2007, I was serving in the heavily Latino Dallas suburb of Farmers Branch when voters approved a city ordinance designed to punish undocumented immigrants. As missionaries, we lived fairly disconnected lives, no newspapers, no social media, so I didn't know at the time that the crackdown had become a national scandal. But I remember the snippets of hushed conversation, la migra, miedo, that I caught at the laundromat. I remember the Sunday after the referendum passed, the women huddled, crying in the church foyer, the chapel half full for the Spanish service because so many members feared crossing town lines. And I remember the branch president, a young Guatemalan dad with glasses, abandoning his usual soft-spoken style to reassure his shaken congregation. "You are children of God," he thundered. "Never, never let them make you feel like less." So little about their experience was truly accessible to me, but I felt a flicker of solidarity in that moment that I hoped would never be stamped out. On a sticky summer evening in Brooklyn, the Bushwick branch of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints threw a karaoke night. The congregation was small but eclectic, and as members took the turn at the microphone, the wonderful weirdness of the Mormon community was on full display. A missionary from Hong Kong crooned a pop ballad in Cantonese. A petite goth fashion designer headbanged to Metallica, while young dads scurried about filling plastic cups with Sprite and replenishing the pretzel bowl, older members from Guyana and the Philippines sang their favorite songs. Mormonism has a reputation for conformity, starched white shirts and white picket fences and broods of well-behaved white children. But in much of the world, Mormon congregations are characterized by the way they force together motley groups of people from different backgrounds. Unlike most American Christians, Latter-day Saints don't get to choose whom they go to church with. They're assigned to congregations based on geographic boundaries that are often gerrymandered to promote socioeconomic diversity. And because the church is run almost entirely by volunteers, and every member is given a job, they have to work together closely. Patrick Mason, a historian of religion, calls this the sociological genius of Mormonism. In a society of echo chambers and bowling alone, he says, the church has doubled down on an old-fashioned communitarianism. In some ways, the Bushwick congregation where my wife and I landed after moving to New York was unusual. It was more diverse than a typical Mormon ward and more bootstrapped. We met in a retrofitted space leased from a Jewish community center across the street from a public housing complex. When our Sunday morning services were interrupted by a subwoofered SUV parked outside, our branch president, a bearded filmmaker with a conciliatory approach to neighborhood relations, would slip outside and offer the driver a 20 to take the music down the block. We took turns teaching Sunday school and delivering sermons. When one of us lost a job, somebody would stop by with a carload of groceries. When one of us had to change apartments, we'd all show up with cardboard boxes and donuts. At work, I was surrounded by 20-something journalists with similarly curated Twitter feeds. But at church, my most meaningful relationships were with people who resided well outside my bubble, middle-aged mail carriers and Caribbean immigrants, white-haired retirees and single parents navigating the city's morass of social services. Our little community wasn't perfect. We argued and irritated one another, and more than once a heated Sunday school debate ended in shouting and hurt feelings. But the dynamic was better than utopian. It was hard. Over time, we learned to live a portion of our lives together, to mourn with those that mourn, as the Book of Mormon teaches, and comfort those that stand in need of comfort. Spencer Cox, who was elected governor of Utah in November, told me that his state has been shaped by this ethic. When the Mormon pioneers first arrived in the territory in 1847, they built their homes in village centers and established their crops on the outskirts of town so that farmers weren't isolated from one another. This was not a place that people were really excited to settle. It was kind of a wasteland, Cox said. To scratch it out here, to make it work, you really had to rely on each other. Though Utah is very conservative, its residents generally don't romanticize rugged individualism or Darwinian hypercapitalism. It has the lowest income inequality in the country and ranks near the top for upward mobility. The relative lack of racial diversity no doubt helps skew these metrics. Structural racism doesn't take the same toll in a state that's 78% white. But economists say the tightly networked faith communities have provided a crucial extra layer to the social safety net. To Mormons, this mindset has always been a matter of theology. Joseph Smith taught that salvation was achieved through community, not individual action alone. And his expansive view of the afterlife, as a kind of sprawling, joyous web of interconnected family reunions, prioritized human relationships. "I would rather go to hell with my friends," he was said to have preached, "than to heaven alone." In 1863, a writer for the Atlantic named Fitzhugh Ludlow traveled to the Mormon settlement in Utah and was surprised by what he found. In his 11,000-word dispatch, Ludlow presented the strange desert civilization of exiles as a study in contradictions. The Mormons were clearly theocratic, yet he found no evidence of corruption. Their open embrace of polygamy was scandalous, yet somehow appeared more practical than lascivious. Their beliefs were preposterous, but sincere. The Mormons Ludlow encountered seemed to believe they had something to offer their former nation, now riven by the Civil War. When he talked to Brigham Young, Joseph Smith's bearded, burly successor, the prophet predicted doom for the Union and a flood of immigrants to Utah. After the war, Americans would be drawn to Mormons' comedy and the genius of polygamy, whose appeal would be obvious after so many men died fighting. "When your country has become a desolation," Young told the writer, "we, the saints whom you cast out, will forget all your sins against us and give you a home." Ludlow played the quote for laughs, a sign of the absurd grandiosity of a people who comprised, in his estimation, the least cultivated grades of human society, a heterogeneous peasant horde. He predicted that the church would fall to pieces at once, irreparably, as soon as Young died. But until then, the Mormon threat was not to be taken lightly. Mormonism was, he wrote, disloyal to the core, just like the Confederates. The Mormon enemies of our American ideas should be plainly understood as far more dangerous antagonists than hypocrites or idiots could ever hope to be. Ludlow's story, published in the April 1864 issue, was emblematic of how the rest of the country viewed Utah. Just a few years earlier, President James Buchanan had sent U.S. forces to the territory to put down a rumored Mormon rebellion. The Republican Party, in its founding platform, placed polygamy alongside slavery as one of the twin relics of barbarism. Well, we've run out of time for this week's edition of Religion in the News, but we're only halfway through this article, and we'll wrap up this article entitled "The Most American Religion" next week on Religion in the News. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And don't forget that you can get podcast editions of this and other Religion in the News episodes by visiting our website at ncreadingservice.org. Under the listen area, click the podcast section, and you can download previous editions of Religion in the News. We'll talk to you next week. I hope you have a wonderful week. This has been Religion in the News from the North Carolina Reading Service.